Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, October 23rd. Now, into the third week of the government shutdown, we take a closer look at the sticking point over healthcare. We hear more about billionaire Mark Benioff from a Bay Area reporter following backlash over his comments about the National Guard in San Francisco. We learn about a pineapple grower's woes on the Valley Isle, where water is key, but in short supply. And we spend some time in a Big Island lava tube, which scientists discovered in a deep dive for native species living below ground. And a film featured at the Hawaii International Film Festival looks at women in Buddhism in Hawaii. We hear from the creatives behind the effort. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. November 1st is a deadline looming to begin signing up for health care benefits for next year. And with the federal government shutdown, furloughed workers are apparently being called back to work at the Department of Health and Human Services in anticipation of applications. Healthcare coverage under the Affordable Care Act is at the core of what's keeping Congress at this stalemate. Here with more on that is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so how many people are affected here in the islands?
Yeah, so about 23,000 people in Hawaii use health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, and then about a little over 80% of those people use this thing that's called an expiring enhanced tax subsidy. So since 2021, there have been these enhanced tax credits offered to people who get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, but they expire in 2026. I spoke with Elizabeth Pancotti, the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Groundwork Collective, a progressive think tank that tracks economic policy.
That policy capped what people pay for their health insurance costs at no more than 8% of their income. And so if your premium prices were more than 8% of your income, the federal government kicks in a tax credit to help you afford those. And so that means what you pay every month is a lot lower than the sticker price of that policy for the vast majority of people receiving their health insurance through Affordable Care Act plans get a subsidy to help afford that. That subsidy can be, you know, $10 or $15 a month, or it can be $300 or $400 a month. It is a sliding scale based on your income. So that expansion where the subsidy make your health care no more than 8% of your income, that was a temporary increase, which expires at the end of the year. And so as a result, next year, when folks start paying those premiums, and just next week, when they log in to pick their plans and see those sticker prices, they will see a massive increase.
And, you know, to put that in perspective, it means in Hawaii, a family of four making about $100,000 a year could see an increase of $350 a month to their health plan through the Affordable Care Act if they are using these enhanced subsidies. And so these expiring tax subsidies are really at the heart of the fight in Congress that is causing the government shutdown. You know, Democrats want them extended before they vote to pass a budget. I spoke with State Health Planning Development Agency Director Dr. Jack Lewin, who says the state's Prepaid Health Care Act actually helps protect Hawaii from some of the increased costs. It requires employers to provide health insurance to employees who work more than 20 hours a week, but it doesn't cover everyone.
People here that are self-employed, people who are working on commissions like realtors and some of those folks, they don't count as employed people under the law. So those folks, the small business owners, the gig workers, people working on commissions, they fall through the cracks and they need the exchange.
And that law is actually very unique. Hawaii is, I think, the only state in the country that has this law. And there's like a lot of convoluted ways in which Hawaii was able to get this law in place. But compared to most states in America, Hawaii actually has some of the lowest numbers of residents that actually need to use the Affordable Care Act. But for those it's impacting, the Hawaii Small Business Development Center Executive Director Joseph Burns says these potential increases in health insurance costs really add to the burdens that clients are already facing, like supply chain issues.
It's very serious, and it definitely affects their decisions and will affect their decisions about going forward, or even about starting a business. You know, if these costs are going to become very burdensome and it doesn't work in the business model, this might put someone off to not start a business, or at least not start it now.
And, you know, this is like compounded with the tariffs and the cost of goods. You know, a lot of people that the Hawaii Small Business Development Center works with are people who are doing called like upsold agriculture. So, you know, like chocolate-covered macadamia nuts, things like that. And so the price of goods has gone up. And then also if they're now having to pay these exorbitant amounts of money or for health insurance, that really gives small business owners a pause of like, is this business viable? What things can we cut to make the business plan work out? And then Pancotti added that, you know, those who don't use the enhanced subsidies through the Affordable Care Act will still likely see higher premiums of about 20%. And it's due to a really big combination of factors like tariffs, rising healthcare costs, and the expiration of the subsidies themselves. The idea is that it'll cause healthier people to go without insurance, which will result in a much less healthy pool for insurers, meaning that the amount that insurers will have to pay out will be higher. And then so in that turn, then the premiums of everyone will increase because of these subsidies expiring and people no longer being on health insurance. And so as the government shutdown kind of drags on these subsidies are not extended, it really becomes less and less clear as to what will happen. So there's really three different scenarios that could play out. One, they don't extend the subsidies and people will have to pay these significantly higher premiums. Or two, they extend the subsidies before the enrollment period starts in a week and a half, and that would be a really smooth transition. And then three is the most confusing, where they extend the subsidies, but it's after the enrollment period starts or even after the official period ends on December 15th. And, you know, one of the issues there is just getting the information to people that their policy choices have changed. It's really difficult. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office expects that very few people will actually act if they get that type of communication after already selecting a plan. Pancotti says, you know, one of the issues is that people might see these significantly higher premiums and decide, okay, you know, let me pick something cheaper, like a cheaper plan, even though it doesn't really fit their needs or has huge deductibles. And then we'll have to, you know, look out for these communications if the subsidies are extended and then go back and select a new plan. One bright spot in this is that the Hawaii Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs Insurance Division says that Hawaii is part of the Medicare and Medicaid services federally facilitated marketplace. And that's just a really fancy way of saying that if the subsidies are extended, the federal government is able to make those adjustments and Hawaii will just adjust along with it. But other states who run their own ACA marketplace will have much higher administrative burdens if the subsidies are extended after the enrollment period starts. And then Dr. Lewin says these issues and cuts to Medicaid are things that the state has been really paying attention to, and that, you know, Governor Josh Green has been working with the congressional delegation to solve these issues. He's in D.C. right now as we speak doing that. And, you know, Lewin says that the legislature is also considering how it can help going into next session.
Governor Green is committed to pushing very hard to make sure that the tax credits are extended and that Hawaii is not severely affected. I think legislators are thinking themselves, what can we do? So I think we're considering looking at providing health insurance for keiki who fall through the cracks in our state, because they're not very expensive, but we don't want children to be going without health insurance. We don't want anyone to go without health insurance, but in particular, we want to be able to make sure that our keiki are covered as the first priority.
So they're really trying to come up with different ways to help people who are going to be facing these higher costs. You know, one thing that they've done in the past couple of days is there's an assistance program that the state has had, a federal assistance program that the state has kind of stockpiled a lot of that federal money over the years. They have about $400 million in this thing called TANF. And so now they're making this program to use TANF funds to help people who are being impacted by the government shutdown to help pay utility bills, rent, things like that. And so it really just goes to show that, you know, like these changes that people are going through with their health insurance policies are really going to have like a kind of lasting impact here in Hawaii.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see like what the breakdown is of the 23,000 island by island or, you know, county by county.
Yeah. I've seen some that are broken down by congressional district, but that's like so vast, it's hard to really tell. And really the people who are on the Affordable Care Act here are people who are like entrepreneurs. Some of them are farmers because, you know, if you're self-employed, you're going to have to get health insurance somewhere, and mm-hmm. the Affordable Care Act exchange is one of those places that you would go to do that. In the meantime, if they don't extend those subsidies before November 1st, Pancotti says that people should, you know, maybe keep a lookout to see what plans they might want and not select it until, you know, closer to the deadline date.
Yeah, yeah. So stay tuned.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Ashley. That was HBR's government reporter, Ashley Mizzouo, who is keeping an eye on the local impact of the loss of health care funding under the Affordable Care Act. Some 23,000 people in Hawaii could see their premiums soar next year if the government subsidies end.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, assisting local businesses in reducing energy waste. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton Event Series presents author Pua Aquino this Saturday at 10 a.m. Pua will read from her book, My Kalo Has Lau, as well as lead activities where keiki get to exercise their green thumb with plants. RSVP for this free event at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha United Way, engaging employees and community members to help support nonprofits through workplace giving. Details at auw.org.
This morning, President Donald Trump posted on social media that he would not send in the National Guard to San Francisco, reversing course after he spoke with friends in the area and the city's mayor. The president referenced billionaire Mark Benioff in his social media post. Benioff, the CEO of the tech company Salesforce, has a home on the island of Hawaii. He's been in the news lately, as he had previously told the New York Times he supported sending troops to San Francisco. He later apologized. Since the pandemic, the Salesforce CEO has purchased land and increased his philanthropy in the islands. He also switches voting records from California to Hawaii. Emily Sugarman is a wealth and power reporter at the San Francisco Standard, an online media organization based in the Bay Area. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about how the billionaire has been pulling back from the city by the bay and focusing his attention on Hawaii.
I work for the SF Standard, which is a local San Francisco paper. And obviously, Mark Benioff is a big fixture in San Francisco, not only, you know, as one of the co-founders of Salesforce, which is the largest private employer here, but also just as a philanthropist who's donated hundreds of millions of dollars to San Francisco and been very active in our politics here. And one thing that kept coming up in conversations that I was having with folks here is the feeling that Benioff was not as involved as he used to be. And in fact, the phrase people would use is, Mark Benioff doesn't live here anymore. And I thought, well, that is really interesting. If this man who was a champion of San Francisco for so long, loved to talk about being a fourth generation San Franciscan, if he doesn't live here anymore, that would be something that might be interesting to the people who do live here. And so then that turned into weeks of me calling around, talking to folks in philanthropy, nonprofits, in politics, asking, what have you seen of Mark Benioff lately? And where do you think he lives? And that's how we got to the story.
And I think it's probably important for listeners to know he did text you and say, it's not a secret, I live in Hawaii. I've been living there on and off for decades. But one of the things that you really did was investigate the length to which he really has shifted his thinking, his philanthropy, even his voter registration from California to Hawaii. So tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah. And I think He texted us that, saying that it is no secret that I live in Hawaii, but he also said he spends 75% of his time on the road doing his job. So how can he really be said to live anywhere or not live anywhere? And so we did our best to show that he really has established a home base in Hawaii. First, showing that he did change his voter registration from California to Hawaii in 2021. He also noted, and we had picked up on this as well, that he seemed to have really transitioned his life there more post-pandemic. And he said to us that he had wanted to live in a more low-COVID area where things were more open. Other things we noticed was his growing involvement with Governor Josh Green of Hawaii. He confirmed that the two of them text. They talk not infrequently. He's also been very involved philanthropically on the island, giving very large donations, over $100 million to hospitals, also donating to school districts and other philanthropic causes there. And also just spending an increasing amount of time there. You know, as NPR reported back in 2024, he did make a lot of land purchases on the island. The bulk of those were donated to an affordable housing nonprofit, but he has definitely increased just the amount of land that he owns on the island as well.
And for me, one of the questions that that all raises is that Benioff, the largest private employer, his company Salesforce, and then him also as a philanthropist, one of the largest donors in the city, now seeing that he's shifting a lot of that focus to the Big Island of Hawaii, what do you think people can expect? What seem to be his priorities? How has San Francisco been shaped, and how might Hawaii now be influenced?
When it comes to his priorities, I would say that's the hardest thing to answer, because we have seen a shift in recent years. He went from being seen as a liberal CEO, as someone who offered to relocate his employees out of Texas when they passed restrictive abortion law, who advocated for higher taxes on companies in order to pay for homelessness services, to someone who's now telling the New York Times that he thinks Trump has done a great job and that the National Guard should be sent into San Francisco. That's a pretty marked change in priorities or values. And so I think it's really difficult to predict what he'll put his energy into next. He definitely has spent a lot of his philanthropic dollars on healthcare, and that hasn't really changed. His donations to major medical centers have remained pretty consistent. One other issue he was involved in, as I mentioned before, was this push, we called it Prop C here in San Francisco in 2018, to raise taxes on businesses making over a certain amount of money to fund homelessness services. That was on track not to pass before Benioff got involved, and then he put his money and his kind of star power behind it, and it passed with, I think, something like 60% of the vote. As I said, I'm not sure what his political priorities are going to be going forward, but if he does have them, he will not be shy in exercising them and using what he has to influence outcomes like that.
Is there anything else about your reporting that you think listeners in Hawaii would be interested to learn about?
Yeah, I think it would be very interesting to follow his donations going forward. He has become such a massive philanthropic presence on the island, and told me that he was the biggest philanthropist in Hawaii. I'm not sure if that's true. I haven't actually fact-checked that. We were focusing more on the San Francisco angle of it. But he is clearly someone that politicians there want to court, even if they're not getting donations from him. And it seems like he is exercising a lot of power through philanthropic donations. And I think that's something anyone interested there should keep their eyes on.
That was Emily Sugarman, reporter for the San Francisco Standard. She spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender about reports that billionaire Mark Benioff has shifted his focus and money from California to Hawaii. As of June 2024, the Benioff's total philanthropy in Hawaii exceeded $250 million. We'll have a link to Sugarman's story on our website after the show. This
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. The PGA Tour announced yesterday that it will cancel the Century in Hawaii in 2026. It traditionally marked the season opener for the Professional Golf League. That honor will now go to the Sony Open held at the Wailea Country Club on Oahu. For today's quiz, we dug into golf history in Hawaii. The pastime came to the islands in the late 19th century. Scottish plantation managers built the first courses to remind them of home when they weren't overseeing sugarcane and pineapple plantations. The Moanalua Golf Course on Oahu holds the title of Hawaii's oldest golf course. It was designed by 1898 by Scottish architect Donald McIntyre, but another master course designer is known across the islands for his work on Hawaii's golf courses in the 20th century. This golf course architect was born in England and immigrated to New York when he was just a child. He quickly showed promise as a golfer and pursued golf course designs at Cornell University. His notable work in the islands include designing courses at Ka'anapali and Mauna Kea in the 1960s. For today's quiz, can you name this noted golf course architect who made his mark on our islands? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Maui's developing water situation has put the needs of a pineapple grower and other farmers in the spotlight. The Agribusiness Development Corporation met on Maui for the first time in its 31-year history, and here to talk about it is Maui's Colleen Oweche with the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what can you tell us about this meeting?
Yeah, so this organization, which was created in 1994 by state lawmakers to try and figure out, hey, what can we do with infrastructure that's just sitting around since the closure of a lot of plantations across Hawaii. And so during this meeting, we had a lot of, farmers and, experts on farming and water coming to this meeting and talking about some of their concerns with this board to see how they can help. And so one of the presentations was by the Maui Gold Pineapple Operators, and the issues that they're having are very reflective of what's going on a wider scale here on Maui. They're facing issues with deer, for one. The deer are so populous here on Maui, and they're coming and eating their crops, really impacting a lot of their fields. And drought is the other big issue. It's been so dry here in Maui. I think about 70% of the state is in drought, and in Maui County, it's even worse, over 93%. So it's really, these two problems are really hurting the pineapple operations, and that's the story for so many farmers here on the island.
Yeah, and we understand that the corporation is going island to island, listening, but it just turns out that, there's been so much focus on the Maui drought, right? And I think the farmers just want to be heard as well.
Definitely. And I think that the drought issue is really exacerbated by, there's all these, disputes going on over water. There's a huge history, the way that plantations have used water on Maui has, not been beneficial for the environment, has not been beneficial for Native Hawaiian farmers and cultural practitioners. And so I think in this post-plantation era, we're trying to figure out what does it look like to use water responsibly and make sure there's enough for everyone. And that's the struggle we're going through right now. That's made worse by the fact that there's drought, there's less water, there's less rain. And so we're having to make tough decisions about how we can make sure there's enough water for everybody.
And the pineapple farm really wants to step up its production.
Definitely. So they want to see more agriculture here on Maui, you know, more, you know, local products staying on island. About 90% of their products are staying here and going to local producers who are putting it in maybe their jams or their, you know, going to restaurants and stores. So we want to see more food that's grown here staying here. And so the more agriculture we can have, the better. But then, of course, it continues to bring up this debate over where are we going to get the water from and how do we make sure it's used fairly.
Right. Yeah. They want to make sure that the infrastructure is in good shape and can move water where it needs to go.
Definitely. And when they did have a problem during the fire, there was such high, strong winds. It really it tore the liner on the reservoir that Maui Gold relies on. And of course, in Lahaina, we also had a lot of impacts to the water system there. And that was more so related to the municipal use than to farming. But, you know, we're really trying to move forward and recover from the fire. And that's impacting a lot of people across the island, just in different sectors. And so they finally repaired that liner and they're getting water back to their crops. But this is a problem, too, is that sometimes the infrastructure is impacted. It's very expensive to maintain and repair. And there's just not enough workers in the, you know, water infrastructure workforce to be able to take care of that on a regular basis.
Well, anything more on the feral animal front, you know, with the deer and the pigs?
That continues to be the issue that vexes so many people. You know, the governor recently extended that emergency proclamation to help farmers and other folks who are impacted by deer and pigs, mostly deer, impacting their crops. But it's tough when there's just thousands of deer, and it's really tough to control the population and protect these crops. And I think fencing is a big part of it, but farmers and the state are really trying to work on what are more solutions we can find for protecting our crops from the deer.
I know it's tough. Farmers just don't get a break. But thank you so much, Colleen.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been hearing from Colleen Oeche from the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. Read her story at MauiNow.com. Now it's time to check our mailbag. We got feedback over our coverage of the signing of the downtown Honolulu Business Improvement District. Longtime resident and former neighborhood board member Lynn Matasau expressed her fears about increased problems with the homeless and crime in Chinatown. She lamented the progress in sustaining the community's past efforts, as she put it, one step forward, two steps back.
You know, the area is different than it used to be. I remember when we started with the Citizens Patrol years ago, there was huge interest. Huge. You know, there were times they would get 60, 70 people out. Now they get maybe 10. It's a challenge. It's a challenge for everything. Somebody called me yesterday that they were upset over something and we should start to react to it. And I said, it's too soon. I said, because you'll probably get people to show up once or twice. And it's not ready for that yet. I think we have to get the community more involved, and I don't know how you go ahead and do it.
And following our On the Road show in Chinatown yesterday and our interview with Honolulu City Council member Tyler DeSantos Tam, Melvin chimed in on Facebook with this suggestion. Maybe if you provide better parking spaces, a lot more people will go. After driving around and around and not finding parking, most people just leave. And in response to our coverage of the No Dictators protests held this past weekend, we received this message from Judith White. She writes, here on Kauai, we had two well-attended protests on October 18th, Princeville in the morning, which drew an estimated 600 people, and Lehui in the afternoon, which was attended by an estimated 1,400 folks. And we received a voicemail on our talkback line about a recent segment featuring artist and musician Benjamin Fairfield.
Aloha. This is Jenny from KL. I really enjoyed the current conversation that had the Kani Ka'opala. And I really appreciated someone who's looking after our island in such a creative way. And the instruments were amazing. It was quite touching. Thank you for airing it.
And we do welcome your feedback. Leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. A dark, damp cave full of beetles, centipedes, and spiders. It's enough to make your skin crawl. But for University of Hawaii at Manoa researchers, Megan Porter and Becky Chong, it sounds like a wonderland. The two have been working to map the insect biodiversity brimming within Hawaii Island's lava tubes. HBR Savannah Harriman-Pote spoke with Porter and Chong back in 2022 after they first received funding from the National Science Foundation to explore the Big Island's subterranean world. That funding wraps up in a few months. Harriman-Pote checked back in with Porter and Chong to see what they had found, and they invited her to tag along on a bug hunting mission.
There are very few places that there isn't either light from the sun, from the stars, or some sort of man-made light. This is the only place I can think of that there's no light whatsoever.
This is what it's like inside of one of Hawaii Island's lava tubes. Outside, it's just after midday, and the sun is shining down. But here, encased in rock, researcher Megan Porter is completely out of the light's reach.
If you put your hand in front of your face, you'll touch your face before... because you just can't see where it is.
Total darkness may sound terrifying to some, but for Porter, there's a kind of reverence in her voice when she talks about it.
I actually love it. I've been caving a long time, and there's no place more peaceful than a cave passage. If you sit still, you can hear your own heartbeat. It's so silent.
It feels empty, but there are creatures that live in this quiet, lightless world. Insects with names like cave treader, springtail, assassin bug. And they're uniquely adapted to spend their entire lives in the dark, says researcher Becky Chong.
They've never seen light. Very few have ever existed in twilight. Most of them only live their entire lives in the deep dark. And so most of the taxa we work on actually have very little pigment. So no color. They tend to be pretty pale white or reddish, brownish, losing a lot of the colors we think about insects having on the surface. And then probably one of the more extreme physical traits would be loss of eyes, because it turns out when you live in the dark, it's not so useful to have eyes.
Since 2022, Megan Porter and Becky Chong have spent countless hours underground surveying the species that spend their lives in lava tubes. Hawaii Island alone has hundreds of miles of these underground tunnels. But Porter says for a long time, this subterranean environment was overlooked.
Dr. Frank Howarth was the first one really to come underground and recognize this really unique ecosystem in the early 70s. And so he did the foundational work in describing a lot of the ecosystems in terms of who's here. But there's still so much to do. We're still finding new species all the time.
Porter and Chong's work focuses on how different biological communities within distinct cave systems are evolving. So far, they've helped to formally describe three new cave species, with more in the works. But with their grant winding down next year, this work may come to a halt unless they can secure a new source of funding. Chong is hopeful they'll find the support they need to continue.
It's just a lot more to learn, and that it's a worthy investment.
Here's a refresher on how lava tubes are formed. During an eruption, lava rushes like a river towards the ocean. As it flows, it begins to cool along the sides and then over the top.
And that insulates the lava that's still flowing on the inside. So you get an insulated tube that has hardened around the outside while the hot lava is still flowing through the inside. And then at some point, it stops flowing and it drains out and you're left with this tube inside the rock.
Porter and Chong bring their colleagues into a tunnel system in the southern part of Hawaii Island. They carefully pit their way through loose lava rock and enter a cavern the size of a cathedral. It's over 800 years old. You have to be careful when you're entering a lava tube. For one thing, they may contain iwi kupuna, or ancestral bones, or other sensitive cultural sites. Only enter a cave when you have permission from its steward, and try not to disturb anything. They can also be treacherous. Today, everyone's wearing pads and helmets, the importance of which becomes clear when Chon stands up a little too fast in a low passageway. But if you know where to look in these caves, you can see all kinds of strange critters. Chon points out a tiny white springtail. It looks like a sesame seed with legs.
You see that one little white speck moving at the edge of the rock?
Oh, God. Wow, I cannot believe you saw that.
Elsewhere in the passage, Porter is gently nudging a moth with a paintbrush.
The question is whether or not it's alive. Nope. when they die, they mummify a little bit, so sometimes it's hard to tell.
Just a dark cave full of bug mummies.
Yeah. Whoop. Oh, it was playing dead. It was alive.
It may feel like another world within the cave, but life below ground is tied to the surface. Roots of ohia trees hang from the tunnel ceilings like long strands of hair. Porter says these roots serve a critical function.
These are the primary nutrient source into these systems, right? These are bringing nutrients that are generated by the plants above using sunlight into the cave system.
The cave's keystone species, the plant hopper, is a tiny, pale creature that ranges in size from a grain of rice to a dried black bean. The plant hopper does this cool thing where it secretes a waxy, almost cotton-like substance from its rear end that it uses to create these protected cocoons. You can see them dotting the ohia roots like cotton balls. And that plant hopper is able to get nutrients from the ohia roots by sucking out their sap.
And then everything else eats that, basically. So the plant hoppers eat the roots, everything else eats the plant hopper. But it gets enough nutrients that you get a really unexpectedly diverse food web down here. So at the top, we have wolf spiders and assassin bugs and cave treaders. And then there's this whole middle level and of things that sort of eat the detritus. So millipedes and isopods and beetles and amphipods, an unexpectedly diverse set of things live down here.
Because of the important role ohia trees play in this system, the health of the cave is dependent on the health of Hawaii's native forests. Porter and Chon hope to better understand how factors like rapid ohia death, a fungal disease that has killed more than 1 million ohia trees, might shape the future of Hawaii's subterranean world.
And I still feel like we're just scratching the surface.
Those were researchers Megan Porter and Becky Chong talking about the biodiversity within Hawaii Island's lava tubes. HBR's Savannah Herman-Pote tagged along on her recent expedition to a lava tube on the island of Hawaii. Want to see some of those bugs yourself? Well, you get a chance. No caving required. Porter and Chong are working with the Bishop Museum on Oahu to update their Hawaiian cave arthropod exhibit that should open in May of 2026. Now it's time to tee up the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history of golf in Hawaii. The game was brought here by Scottish plantation managers, and it took off in the 20th century as a pastime for locals and visitors alike. The Wailea Country Club golf course has been part of the PGA Tour schedule since 1965. It will now be the kickoff tournament to the 2026 tour, following the cancellation of the century on Maui. We told you about a noted golf course architect who designed the courses in Ka'anapali and at Mauna Kea. His son followed in his father's footsteps and has designed 10 courses in the islands, including courses in Poipu, Princeville, Waikoloa, and Wailea. For today's quiz, we asked you to name this preeminent golf course architect with a Hawaii connection. We were looking for Robert Trent Jones Sr. And we got a lot of call from golfers today, I can tell you that. But Paul from Kaneohe had the fastest fingers. That's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, write the talk back at hawaiipublicradio.org. The documentary Nā Wā Hine Buddha recently sold out both of its screenings at the Hawaii International Film Festival. The film tells a story of Buddhism in Hawaii, its history, present, and future. It does so through exploring the essential role that many women played in bringing Buddhism to the islands and elevating it through the generations. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with the director of the film, Eleni Gil Avendano, along with John Matsuoka and Anna Shilseth, two producers who work with her to complete the project. Avendano opens by describing the film.
Our film is in two parts, and the first part is looking at a historical figure here in Hawaii named Mary Mikahala Foster, and she's mysterious. You might have heard her name because her name is behind Foster Botanical Gardens in downtown Honolulu, and she's known as the first Hawaiian Buddhist, but a lot is unknown about her. And so when John approached me about this idea for a film, I was really intrigued because having been born and raised here, I've been to Foster Botanical Gardens. I really knew so little about who she was. And her life is really the stuff of novels. And the second half of our film is a series of profile interviews with these amazing Hawaiian wahine who have brought their own spiritual mix that touches upon Buddhist thinking, but also very much Native Hawaiian thinking. And they have so much mana'o to share. And so we felt it was important to sit down with them and talk to them about their life and how Buddhism has shaped their outlook on life, their activism, their art. And we came away feeling very inspired, and we hope our viewers of this film feel inspired as well.
Yeah, you really lay a historic foundation there and sort of springboard everybody into the present day. John, it sounds like perhaps this project might have originated with you, or you might have been there from the start. Talk about that point of origin and what inspired you to come to Eleni with the film idea.
Well, most recently, I was working at the Hopohonganji Hawaii Betsuin, and I was able to learn more about the life and times of Mary Mikahala Foster. And we started having concerts in her honor at the botanical gardens on her birthday or near her birthday, Japanese expressions. And they were really well attended. Along with that, in learning more about Mary Mikahala Foster, I just had some very dear friends that were Hawaiian women Buddhists. Punani Burgess, who's been a dear friend of mine for many, many years, many decades, recently passed about a year ago, and Manu Meyer, who is this remarkable person, grew up Catholic and became a Buddhist as an adult after going to India and going on this quest to find something that was more of, you know, better fit in terms of her spirituality, and Norma Wong, who is also an ordained priest along with Pua Burgess at a temple in Kalihi Valley, and a former state legislator. They are part of a lineage, beginning with Mary Mikahala Foster, the first Hawaiian women Buddhist. They're just these amazing leaders in the history of Hawaii, both politically, spiritually, and beyond. But these women, for the most part, were raised Christian, and at some point in their life went on a spiritual quest to look for something that was more germane and more complementary to their spiritual orientation. And they found Buddhism. So they grafted Buddhism onto this Hawaiian spiritual base, and they came up with something really profound.
Jumping off of that point you just made, John, I want to ask, bring you into the conversation, Anna. And it seems like the history that's spelled out in the film in terms of the time that Mary Foster was living in, the time that just preceded her, was very complicated in terms of some of the old spiritual beliefs being questioned, Christianity and the missionaries becoming a huge presence in the island. But Mary Foster seems to have been defined by her pursuit of looking for something beyond Christianity.
Exactly. And I think that speaks to not only discovering her sense of connection to place and her identity, but how it expands this conversation of like, okay, how can I look to not only my people, but to something even greater, like in her relationship to God and her quest for God. And it seems like in her journey, it was through Buddhism. But I think the film also distincts the fact that it wasn't just Buddhism exactly, but it was also her relationship with her people.
Something that stood out to me about her story was how she was dealing with the days of the overthrow and Queen Liliuokalani being imprisoned, locked up. Talk about how she brought spirituality into dealing with those circumstances for herself and the queen.
Yeah, so we don't know that much about Mary Foster from her own writings, but we do know, thanks to the diaries of a man named Anugarika Dharmapala, how she was feeling at that time. And he was kind of known as one of the first missionaries, if you will, of Buddhism globally. And they met by chance here in the islands when he stopped by. And according to his diaries, she was using a mindful meditation called Vipassana to cope with the feelings she was going through after the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy and what was happening to her personal friend, Queen Liliuokalani. And so we were able, through archives and thanks to the book written by Pat Masters called Searching for Mary Foster, we were able to piece together a better picture of who Mary Foster was and how she was feeling at that time. But, you know, the more you learn, there's still a lot of mystery and a lot more to learn about her.
One of the thoughts in the film that stood out to me, Anna, was governments will come and go, but if we lose the essence of who we are, then all will be lost. Respond to that a little bit. I think it has special resonance here in Hawaii.
Right. Well, in the film, when we talk about legacy, right, it seems like each woman in their role, of their place, of their identity, and their connection and kinship to Hawaii, you see them kind of walking on their journey of, like, discovering who they are, but then also what is their kuleana. And as Auntie Puanani would teach in her Building the Beloved Circle, she would tell those that if you call Hawaii home, then you have a kuleana to this place. And whatever that looks like for you, whether you are Hawaiian or non-Hawaiian, like, we have our sense of responsibility. And what I hear in all of their stories is we have to not only remember our past, but, like, what are we bringing forth into the future? And so the sense of legacy is greater than just all of us. It's our collective for our future generation, for our children. And so I think that's the hope of this film, too, beyond not just Buddhism, but, like, what is our responsibility to place, and also what are the values that we can bring forward to bring connection and not conflict, but also how to navigate conflict, too.
Something that stood out to me in the film is that Buddhism, there's something that seems so very individualistic about it, something, to put it in sort of Christian terms, Gnostic about it, that allows a person to carve out their own journey. And I feel like that might be a part of the future of Buddhism in Hawaii, continuing to provide that opportunity for people to individualize it and approach it as they need to, as an individual.
Yeah, I think my main takeaway is I like to reflect on what Auntie Manu speaks about, where she highlights these parallels between aloha and Buddhist thought, or even in Christian thought, right? We have something called pono aku, pono mai, aloha aku, aloha mai, kokua aku, kokua mai. You know, whatever you give will come in return. So there's this mutual emergence where you reap what you sow. I love how that same frame of thought can be found in different religions and with the same moral, and looking at the definition of aloha, when you look at Auntie Pilahi Paki's definition, you know, it's that humble attitude that you only gain by helping others. And aloha is to embrace different people and different cultures that we have in Hawaiʻi and expanding upon that. And that's something that Kumu Puakea Nogelmeyer mentioned to me, is what he took away from this film, seeing how that essence of aloha is reflected in Buddhism, in other religious frames of thought, is really beautiful. And I think in today's day and age, any knowledge, mana'o, that we have, ike kupuna, about coexistence is something to be expanded upon.
I just want to add on to that. So a person that I know, Bishop Marvin Harada, who's the bishop for Buddhist Churches of America, claims that Buddhism is the fastest growing religion in North America. It's very relevant, especially in this day and age amid so much chaos. And it's growing because it's diversifying. So you have people from all different cultures. There's a growing number of African American Buddhists. There's a growing number of Jewish Buddhists. There's a growing number of Buddhists from various ethnic communities. And yet it's shrinking in Hawaii. So you have to juxtapose that dynamic to try and figure that out. What has to happen is that it has to become more diversified in Hawaii. And perhaps to your question, you know, people take it and interpret what it is for themselves, and they begin to practice it in various different ways.
I wonder if we could just close by going around to the three of you. Anna, I'll start with you. You've all given good shout outs to some of the modern day wahine that are in the second half of the film. But I'm wondering if there's a specific individual or a specific thought that really, really stands out for you as you revisit those voices in your head from the second half of the film, those modern day voices.
I would say my closing thought would also be on what Manu had spoke about. You know, your suffering is my suffering and your liberation is my liberation. And my biggest takeaway from that moving forward in my life, in the roles that I play as well outside of the creative arts, is the children. I predominantly work with children and work with different communities that are at need. My aloha is to help and support and uplift all of us. And what does that look like, right? And so that personal question when she stated that was my biggest takeaway that I would want to hone into of what does that look like in your life?
We had the honor of having the last interview with Auntie Puanani Burgess, who passed away just a couple months after we sat down with her. And so each time I watch her on film, I still get chicken skin. She is just so wise. And one memorable moment from that interview is when she talks about her mango tree. And she loves to sit under that mango tree and contemplate that mutual relationship we have with nature. And that tree is providing her oxygen. And so really grounding your senses in your surroundings and the aina and finding your breath and grounding yourself when you're confronted by times of conflict or you are discussing something that is difficult is a lesson that everyone can take away. And Auntie Puanani Burgess was such a special human, and I'm eternally grateful that we were able to document her on tape while we had her.
Hawaii is this incredible place, and sometimes we forget that we are this fusion of so many different cultures that created this very unique and special kind of brilliance. And we're also very spiritual. So I think the combination of that spiritual intelligence and indigeneity and other philosophical orientations like Buddhism, I think brought together can take us to a place where humanity can evolve in a peaceful manner.
That was HPR's G.W. Gibson talking to Eleni Gil Abendano, the director of Na Wahine Buddha, along with two of the film's producers, John Matsuoka and Anna Shilseth. For more information about future screenings of the film and others, visit our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we hear about an upcoming photography exhibit that focuses on the downtown and Chinatown area. It's called River to Richards. Give us some feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.